Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service of the UN here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 8th of August, and we are going to have several guests today to tell you about the catastrophic situation in Sudan. So we have with us colleagues from UNHCR here on the podium, but also from Port Sudan and N'Djamena. We also have WHO to speak about the health challenges in the country. And as had been requested by some of you in one of the past briefings, we would like to thank the colleague from UNMAS who is joining us from Port Sudan to tell us about the situation of the explosive remnants in the country. So we'll have the three agencies briefing, and then I will open the floor to questions. Let's start with UNHCR. Eugene, you want to take the floor first and introduce your colleagues.
Good morning, everyone. As Alessandra just mentioned, that the humanitarian situation in Sudan, as well as eastern Chad, is worsening by day. Today's briefing will focus on the two pressing and interconnected crises: the recent cholera outbreak among Sudanese refugees in eastern Chad, and the deepening life-saving need of a forcibly displaced community in Darfur. Today's briefing will be presented by Patrice Awansu, UNHCR's principal situation coordinator in eastern Chad, and Jocelyn Knight, our protection officer based in Port Sudan, covering Darfur region. They will give a first-hand update from the ground, describing the worsening condition of displaced population in both eastern Chad and Darfur, as well as the daily challenges faced by humanitarian teams trying to deliver aid. I'm also pleased to be joined by my colleague Sandra Halas, our senior public health officer, who is available to respond to any technical question related to the cholera outbreak and our ongoing health response in the region. Today, we're also releasing a new report that highlights the urgent needs of a displaced community in Darfur and the critical effort to relocate refugees in eastern Chad. It outlines the scope of the crisis, the challenges based on the ground, and the immediate funding needed to save lives and scale up assistance. The full report is linked in the briefing note, which you should have received already, and then as well as the B-roll is available within the briefing note. I will give a floor to first to my colleague Jocelyn, connected from Port Sudan.
Okay, thank you so much. I want to emphasize first that the situation in Sudan is really a massive protection crisis, particularly in Darfur, where we have seen for over 2 years now ongoing large-scale displacement and ongoing violence and fighting as a result of this conflict. All of the impacts of that protection crisis manifest in different ways. So at the moment, of course, cholera is a key concern, and we have seen case numbers rising in places like Tooele. But even in addition to cholera before that and still continuing now, concerns about deepening and broadening food insecurity, for example, all of these impacts tie back to the protection drivers of the crisis. So when we have had such large scale ongoing displacement for so long into really deteriorating conditions where people lack the basics for a dignified survival, shelter, a mat to sleep on, a blanket, a tarpaulin to keep the rain off, then of course risks of communicable diseases will be higher. Similarly, for food insecurity, people are not safe to be able to engage in agricultural activities the same way that they did before the crisis. So of course then food insecurity will increase. We see that agricultural inputs are not available to the same extent, markets are not functioning as well. So of course, as a result of the violence, as a result of the protection crisis, all of these impacts are being exacerbated and compounding one another to continue to worsen the situation for people in Darfur. I was in Tooele in early May, a few weeks after the attacks on Zamzam IDP camp that led to displacement of hundreds of thousands of people in a very short period of time. And one of the striking things that I heard repeatedly when talking to people there is just the continuing insecurity that they feel. Tooele is regarded as a relatively stable location. There is a large humanitarian presence there from different agencies. So in the context of North Darfur, it is considered somehow safe. But talking to people there, you know, they're very aware that Al-Fashir is not very far away distance-wise. Zamzam IDP camp, or what used to be Zamzam IDP camp, is also not very far away distance-wise. They're very conscious of the continuing threats that surround them, the continuing insecurity that they face. People told me multiple times that when they were fleeing from Zamzam, armed people would threaten them while they were in flight, saying, sure, flee, go to that place, run here, run there. We will follow you. We will find you. You know, we will get you wherever you go. And this insecurity really lives with people, you know, to whichever place they try to go. I was talking to a group of children that, you know, were engaged in some of the services and activities that we support there. Just, you know, a normal conversation about, you know, what is it like? Are you playing with your friends? Do you like these games? And a tiny boy told me, you know, during the day things are okay here, but I'm afraid to go to sleep at night in case the place where we're living is attacked again. And this is the fear that people are living with on a daily basis that is really at the root of all of the impacts that are then impacting their lives, whether it's cholera, food insecurity, lack of shelter, you know, other deteriorating conditions. These protection drivers of the crisis are the most fundamental impact on every dimension of the lives of the affected people there. Effort to really make sure that people understand the need to scale up the response to those needs and give people better, safer conditions in which to live is a really important one. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jocelyn. And I'll give the floor now to Dosu Patrice.
Yeah, good morning. I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me?
We do. We can hear you very well.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm talking to you from N'Djamena. My name is Patrice Avansu, Principal Situation Coordinator for UNHCR in Eastern Chad. Exactly 2 months ago, on June 3rd, I was before this assembly and briefed you about the deepening humanitarian situation in Eastern Chad, where the number of Sudanese refugees has doubled in 2 years and has tripled in two decades. I vividly remember that during that briefing, I told you about a little girl called Hawa. I told you a story about Hawa. Hawa, whose parents were killed in Sudan and whose leg was amputated. I visited Hawa and her sisters last week in Amjaras, in the northern part of the East settlement. And she told me that please thank those who are giving you money, literally, you know, to for you to be able to support us. She said, I have my family now has shelter, I can eat food and I can play with other children. But at the same time, she's afraid, exactly what Jocelyn has just described. She says she's afraid that the perpetrators might come back. She's afraid because she is having a lot of nightmares. And her sister, 18 years old, told me she's very worried. She's worried because a deadly cholera outbreak has just hit a refugee settlement in Eastern Chad. And as a consequence, all this because, in fact, as of early August, 264 cholera cases have been reported by the government in Dugi settlement, and 12 deaths. As a consequence, UNHCR has suspended the relocation of refugees from border points in order to prevent new cases. And to curb this spread, you know, many activities are being implemented. For instance, soap is being distributed, stations are being set up to facilitate access to water and also for hand washing. Medical equipment and supplies and protective also equipment are being distributed by various organizations, including World Health Organization, UNICEF, MSF, UNHCR. But despite all these actions, you know, border locations where we still have a third of new arrivals still live in overcrowded settlement with insufficient water, health facilities, hygiene facilities, and these border points are seriously at the risk of transmission of cholera because it is overcrowded. For instance, the Adre settlement that is very famous, that everybody knows about, we still have more than 230,000 refugees at the border in very difficult situation. So without urgent action, you know, including enhancing access to medical treatment, to clean water, to sanitation, to hygiene, and most importantly, relocation from the border, you know, many more lives are on the line. So I would like to urge you, and thank you for all the support you have been providing, to urge you that the urgency for us today is to be able to decongest the spontaneous site in border points, and to be able also to provide healthcare and to provide shelter, to provide drinking water, to provide sanitation facilities. For your information, out of the 153,000 households that have been received by the Chadian government since April 2023, only 48% have access to shelter. All the rest, no shelter, exposing them to many risks, including the risk of contamination. So thank you for your attention, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrice. Let's hear more about the CDF situation in the country with Christian and Dr. Hilam Noua, Senior Emergency Officer. I don't know, Christian, if you want to start or I'll go straight to
Dr. You said it already. Thank you very much, Alessandra, and thanks to the colleagues. I'm happy that we could, at short notice, bring our colleague, Senior Emergency Officer here at HQ in Geneva, Dr. Hilam Noua, and she will give an update, and then of course ready for questions. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Yes. You're on.
Thanks to our colleagues from UNHCR for the sobering briefing, and we would just this morning would like to provide a little bit more perspective on the overall health situation in Sudan. So relentless violence has pushed Sudan health system to the edge, adding to a crisis marked by hunger, illness, and despair. Since the start of the conflict, WHO has verified 174 attacks on health, leading to 1,171 deaths and 362 injuries, and impacting health facilities. Attacks on healthcare is a violation of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and should facilities and health workers and patients should be protected. Cholera has swept across Sudan, with all the states reporting outbreaks. Nearly 100,000 cases have been reported since July last year, and thanks to our colleagues in UNHCR again for highlighting that situation. There are also outbreaks of measles, malaria, dengue, and polio. Exacerbating the disease burden is hunger. Nearly 26 million people are acutely food insecure, and famine is present in several areas in Darfur and Kordofan, and including also in Nuba Mountains in Kordofan, with a risk of further expansion, especially as we are in the lean seasons, which run between July and September. The health consequences are alarming. About 770,000 children under 5 years are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, or are actually suffering from severe acute malnutrition this year. UNICEF has already reported that in Darfur, the number of children under five receiving treatment for severe acute malnutrition has increased by 46% in the first 5 months of 2025. Severe acute malnutrition is a life-threatening condition, as you all know, as you all know, that greatly increases the risk of children dying from common illnesses like diarrhea and pneumonia and others. Large part of the countries, mainly Darfur and Kordofan, have been cut off by intense fighting. Reports out of those areas speaks of harsh conditions in addition to hunger and disease. We estimate that 3 of every 4 health facilities are no longer functioning, leaving people with little access to essential health care, even as the needs mount. Some parts of the country, like Khartoum, have become accessible over the recent months, and WHO has re-established presence there and also undertook activities there. A large cholera vaccination campaign was recently conducted there with WHO support, and we are seeing initial signs of a slowing down of the cholera epidemic. However, there remains gaps in disease surveillance and any progress is fragile. And thanks again to our UNHCR colleagues for providing a lot of highlights on cholera. But it doesn't stop there. Recent floods are also affecting large parts of the country and are expected to worsen the hunger and disease. WHO has prepared for the rainy seasons by prepositioning essential medicines and supplies, by training a rapid response team, by strengthening disease surveillance and early warning systems, and also by scaling up some activities related to water sanitation and hygiene interventions. Overall, collectively, the health partners are supporting around 1,244 health facilities all over the country. This includes WHO, which is currently supporting 33 hospitals and 60 primary healthcare centers, and we are planning and expanding to more. So WHO and the health partners, as UNHCR has also pointed out, we're supporting with critical health supplies, training, even operational support for some of these facilities. When it comes to malnutrition, the 142 nutrition stabilization centers that are supported by WHO have so far treated nearly 20,000 severely malnourished children with medical complications, but we believe that many, many more remain beyond reach. Our efforts and those of our partners are constrained by severely limited access, especially in Darfur and Kordofan, bureaucratic and logistic impediments, and lack of funding. And just for that point, 171 health facilities in the country have been affected by funding cuts, with 81 facilities that have already suspended operation. The areas most affected by these cuts are, again, the ones that are most in need, Darfur and Kordofan. So just to wrap up, the people living in these areas desperately need respite. WHO is committed, along with our partners and along with the UN agencies, to serving their needs. And we urge you, the eyes of the world, to not look away. Thank you so much. Back to you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And requested from by the journalist, I am very happy now to give the floor to Mohamed Sadiq Rashid, who is the chief of the Mine Action Program, who's joining in from Port Sudan. Sadiq, thank you very much for being with us. The issue of the explosive remnants of war are very important, is very important in Sudan. So I'll give you the floor to tell us about that.
A very good morning, and thank you very much for inviting us. Indeed, as you mentioned, explosive remnants of war, landmines. This is one of the serious implications of the ongoing war, and it was a serious implication of the previous wars as well. So I'd like to very briefly outline what the problem is now, and what is the impact, what is currently happening, and what is the gap. So just a few points to note. First of all, as I mentioned, Sudan has experienced a lot of conflicts. So when we talk about explosive remnants of war or landmines, it is linked. It is something that is left behind from armed battles. When the conflict happens, please be reminded that in most cases, they leave behind very dangerous unexploded ordnance. And the sad reality of this ongoing conflict is it is not happening in the rural areas. It's mainly happening in urban areas, in the areas which are highly populated. So that's the implication of the unexploded ordnance is very, very severe. Because the contamination is on the roads, in the homes, in schools, in airstrip, medical facilities, humanitarian bases. So, and also another point to note is that the people who are affected are people who are in the urban areas. They were not exposed to the mine action services in the past because the explosive hazard problem in the past was in the rural areas. So this is, the population is largely unaware of the dangers that are waiting for them. So the other problem is that as the conflict is ongoing, so this problem is only growing every day. So every day we hear about new battles. There are unexploded ordnance. And also just to tell you that last week, six minefields were confirmed in Khartoum. Three of them contains anti-personnel landmine, which is the first time we hear. So far, the main problem was unexploded ordnance. And we had heard quite a few reports about the use of anti-vehicle landmines, but now it's anti-personnel landmines are also confirmed. When we find one or few, more are expected. It's not in Khartoum, but also in other urban areas. So, in terms of impact, injuries and deaths, unfortunately, already we are hearing, receiving a lot of reports about casualties. One of them, just as an example, happened last week when one of the kids actually found an unexploded ordnance on the top of the roof, throw it, drop it down among other children, and eight kids were seriously injured. So they are currently hospitalized and under treatment. So this is just one example. It's happening a lot, but we don't hear about this because nobody is talking about this. Media is only reflecting few of those explosions. So in terms of blocking access for civilians, it's blocking access to humanitarian operators. It is blocking access to in terms of recovering the critical infrastructure, essential services, livelihoods. In terms of recovery, I think it's going to becoming a big issue. So that's what just briefly how the problem looks like. I can only summarize that it's significant. It's everywhere. Khartoum was the epicenter, but it's in many towns like South Kordofan, Al Obeid, many other cities, Darfur, all of Darfur has a lot of contamination. In the plan, actually, the program also was affected severely. All the equipments were lost. It's just restarting now with a very small capacity. I can tell you that there are only around 10 survey and clearance teams which are operating, which is really, really small, and only dealing with the most critical areas. So there is a need for expanding efforts. We are working on raising awareness of the population, also among the aid workers, so that they are sensitized that because they will be going to the conflict affected areas. So this is, I think, just in brief. So the problem is big, the capacity is very small. I could give you just an example that when in Afghanistan we were dealing with this problem, we had hundreds of teams, more than 800 teams, and around 15,000 people were working. But in Sudan, the program is really, really small. So with this, I will stop, but looking forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Sadiq, for this. I'll open now the floor to questions. I just wanted to add to what has been said that the OCHA's director of Operations and Advocacy, Edem Vosornu, is in Sudan at the moment, and she will be briefing reporters today. I think it's going to be at the noon briefing in New York, and it will be, of course, webcast. So if you want to hear more from Ocho on the situation of Sudan, from Mrs. Vosornu, describing the situation from there, please connect to the noon briefing. I'll open the floor to questions, but we have an issue with the hand, with the raise hand function. So some of you can see it, some others cannot. I can see it, for example. So we are looking into the question, but could you please use the chat if you want to ask questions to our colleagues so that I can give you the floor, as I won't see your hand. But I see the hand of Catherine Fiancon, so I will start with her. Catherine.
Thank you, Alessandra. Do you hear me?
Not really. Very.
Okay. Do you hear me? Yes.
In the earpiece, yes. We can hear. Okay. But go ahead.
Thank you so much. Yes, I had that issue also with the hand, but you have to enlarge your screen and then you see the hand. I have a couple questions for Mr. Sadiq Rashid. Thank you so much for your briefing, sir. The first question is regarding the teams. You mentioned that you have 10 teams, if I'm not mistaken. So I'd like to know how many people are composing one team. So how many people do you have in one team? You spoke also about the fact that the teams were only working in certain areas. Could you be more precise? Is it only in Khartoum or is it also in other places of the country? And I'd like to know what is the cost of one program? Because you mentioned programs, that you had larger programs in Afghanistan. So I'd like to have an evaluation of the cost of one program. How much money do you need in order to enlarge your action in Sudan? You also said in your briefing that some areas are highly populated regions. Which regions are you talking about? Could you be precise also? And you spoke about the fact that populations are unaware about the danger. Do you intend to have any information programs, and how do you intend to explain to the people what's going on and the danger? Because of course, I suppose that there are no media, maybe radio, local small radio in local languages. And you spoke also about the fact that children played with mines and were hospitalized. So I'd like to know if there are medical facilities able of monitoring people injured by landmines, because I suppose that it's not the case, and so where are those people evacuated to? Thank you for your answer, sir.
Sadiq.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for all those very good questions. First of all, in terms of you asked about the team structure. At the moment, we have designed the team smaller. So it's a team of four operators. And the reason for that is because the priorities are too many. And the teams need to be small so that they could quickly be moved and address the explosive hazard from, for example, from the critical infrastructure. If the water source is being blocked or affected, so make sure that is quickly cleared. As we move on, we are not at the stage of systematic clearance. Actually, the city, not only the capital city, which is we know heavily affected, but many other areas. I will mention which areas requires urgently a systematic clearance operations. make sure that all the residential areas actually are completely cleared from explosive hazards, and then people should go. But the reality is that it's not happening. People are going. So that's the team. And when the systematic clearance is started, then the structure of the team will be bigger. For example, 10 operators in each team. I mean, 10, 15 people with all the support staff. Where the teams are working now, the moment work is, in terms of survey clearance, is I would say it's concentrated in Khartoum. Most of the teams are there. We also deployed teams to Al Jazeera State and some other areas. As you know, all the western part of the country remains inaccessible. So in the whole of Darfur, there is nothing. In the whole of South Kordofan, where the conflict is currently going on, we have no resources. So the teams are only operating in certain very few areas, which are now accessible. The cost of the program you mentioned, there are certain elements of the Man Action program which are cheaper. For example, risk education or sensitization of the population. That is the low-cost activity. But when it comes to the clearance, that is sophisticated. In the nature of the contamination in Sudan is now urban areas. Clearing houses with a lot of rebels, this requires a lot of efforts. So the cost is high. I would say that what we proposed for this year during the humanitarian needs overview, humanitarian needs planning, was around $23 million. So from that, a very small percentage has been funded. So even the program needs to grow, we need hundreds of teams to be deployed at the same time to many areas of the country. So the program needs significant resources. With the current resources, we can only do very limited work. So in terms of you mentioned asked about the, which area. So as I said, Khartoum is what remained the epicenter. So and we undertook 4 assessment missions. Our colleagues, when they went, everywhere they went, they either saw an exploded ordnance physically, or they saw the evidence of the presence of an exploded ordnance. So now we have reported the landmine contamination also reported. So for example, other areas, Jazeera State, city itself is not heavily affected, but there are a lot of rural areas, and it is a breadbasket of Sudan. So a lot of rural areas, villages were attacked. So there is unexploded ordnance expected in those areas. And then, for example, North Kordofan, Al-Ubayyid was under a lot of attacks. Unexploded ordnance and possibly landmine are expected to be there. And we should not forget, Al-Fashir has a very, very difficult situation now. And it's besieged, a lot of, every day you look at the news, you hear something that an attack happened. So every attack is actually leaving behind unexploded ordnance. Why I'm saying that? Because generally, up to 10%, even if the ammunition is very, very new, the 10% of the ammunition will not be detonated when it's used. But when, there are other factors like, time, the quality, this percentage will go up. In Sudan, most other factors that will lead to into leaving behind a lot of unexploded ordnance are there. For example, in just 1 month, 4 weeks operations, 2 of our very small teams found more than 1,000 unexploded ordnance, clearing a university, and also schools, and clearing some of the United Nations offices like UNDP, UNICEF, and IOM. So only in those areas, they found more than 1,000 items of unexploded ordnance. So most of them very dangerous. So I think, in terms of children, yes, It's a very, very, very difficult situation, and we are, we are not a health organization, so we are only doing a certain element. We are trying to collect data. We are also, as soon as when we hear about an accident, we make sure that those people who are injured are receiving assistance as quickly as possible. So we refer the cases to the other service providers. And I can tell you that the reporting infrastructure is completely, is not there. So we are only getting information about some of those accidents. And then we do follow up on that. But that certainly needs to be improved. And a lot of many other sectors, many other organizations needs to step up their work on helping the people who are being killed and injured by unexploded ordnance or landmines. And also there is a need to integrate mine action into their work. I think the mine action, as I said, is program is small, and we have many other operators, many other frontline aid workers that they could at least disseminate basic messages to the population. We are doing it. So here I'm also calling on those organizations that they need to extend their help. They need to consider this. When, for example, food is distributed, they can also distribute some basic messages to the population. Yes, I think we are working closely with UNICEF, and they are leading us in terms of awareness raising. We need to integrate risk education into the education system, because now the risk is so widespread, and we cannot, raise awareness of the people without integrating mine action in the work of, into the work of other relevant organizations. So I will stop here. I hope I answered some of your questions.
I see Katrina has a follow-up.
Thank you, Alessandra. And thank you to Mr. Sadiq Rashid. My question is regarding the amount of money needed. You spoke about $23 million, and you say that a very low percentage was funded. What is the figure of the percentage? Is it 5%, 10%? Thank you, sir. And the cost. Because you say that sensitization of population is lower cost as clearance. What is the cost? What is the cost, please? Could you articulate figures?
I think we got the question. Yeah, thank you, Sadiq.
Yes, sorry, I had a problem with unmuting myself. Yes, thank you. The in terms of cost, at this stage, I cannot give you an accurate figure because, first of all, we need to undertake a comprehensive assessment of the problem and identify, how big the contamination is. We're using the open source data now, which is available. For example, the number of battle events that take place. So we are working on it. But at this stage, I cannot tell you how much in precise figures that it will cost. I can tell you that a significant amount of money is required, and it's required urgently to clear, all the urban centers. But we cannot also forget the rural areas that have contamination. In terms of risk education is low cost. Clearance is high cost. And in terms of what percentage we have been funded, we were around 50% funded, but you might remember the funding crisis that came because we were heavily relying at the before March this year on the US funding. And actually all of our 100% of the funding that we had were canceled immediately. So this put us We were about to close in the month of March this year. 30th of March was the last day for us. And when this was a time when Khartoum became accessible, people were giving back. So after that, we had to do, because also, you know, the voice of Sudan is not prominent, you know, in international forums, you know, no one is talking about Sudan in particularly, and also our voice in terms of explosive hazard is very low. We you know, nobody is hearing us. So this problem is so big, and we actively try to engage with the other donors, and with thanks to Canada, who stepped in and saved the program, and then ECHO and other donors, SERF and SHF, contributed to Divine Action. So I would say, you know, about half of the what was required. Actually, the figure that we put together as a required was also, we consider the factor that you can expand to a certain degree, because, you know, another challenging issue for Man Action is bringing in equipment from outside, because the technical equipment we had was all lost during the war. So we could bring in, you know, a certain amount of equipment. But actually now we are in a better position. The program is established, and the program can scale up quicker. So I would say, more resources are definitely needed, and the sense of urgency is very high. Ideally, the areas must be cleared before people go to the areas and use the areas and live in those areas that they used to be before the war. Over.
Thank you very much, Sadiq. Let me see. I don't know if it's because of the issue with the hands, or I can't see any other question on the platform. Is there anybody who would like also to ask? Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, Nick Kamimbrus. Okay, Nick, sorry, I really can't see even your face. So go ahead, please.
Thanks. It's a question for Sadiq. Hi, Sadiq, nice to see you. I just wanted to ask you about the mine fields that you said were identified. Could you just say a little bit more about their location in relation to Khartoum? Are we talking about big mine fields, patterned mine fields? Or are we talking about small, kind of scattered mined areas? And could you just say a little bit of word also about the mines that you're finding there? Are these new imported mines? Are they old things from stockpiles? Do we have any sense of where they came from? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you for your questions. Minefields, as I said, that six minefields are so far discovered and confirmed in the capital city in Khartoum. Most of them, three of them, are in an area called Mogran. Mogran is an area where the two rivers meet. And this is an area, highly residential area. The areas we have deployed, the only available team to make sure that at least to undertake a quick survey of the area, make sure that it's marked. So far we have found, you know, three antipersonal contamination. These are the mines that are in the photos that we have received so far are the mines that used to be, you know, left behind from the previous conflicts. But so far the actual clearance has not begun. So I cannot give you precise information about the type of the mine, when they were brought in, you know, how those things. But it's very, very concerning, very worrying. It seems that the borrowing sites have mines in their possession, and they have also intention of using it. And this is, you know, as you know, the minefields are more and more complex compared to unexploded ordnance when it comes to the clearance. And they are not used in a pattern. These are just randomly used based on, you know, those people who are involved in the war. They see that they see a threat from a side. They think that the enemy will come from this direction, so they go and plant a few mines there. These are, as you know, Nick, are very difficult to deal with compared to minefields that are laid in a proper pattern. Once you find a, you know, one corner of the pattern, then you can easily, you know, identify the real boundary of the minefields. But yeah, this is very complex. And then we have a lot of reports which are not yet verified about the use of anti-tank mines with a relatively organized manner. But so far, only three of them have been confirmed, which are in the capital of Sudan. So there were reports from other areas as well. As I said, that access for us is very limited. I think it will take some time to, you know, to get more precise information.
Thank you very much. Thanks. I'm looking at my colleague if they by chance see any. No, there is no other question. No questions for WHO and UNHCR. Let me look at the chat. No, there's no other question. So thank you very much for this very extensive briefing. Thanks for the brief from our colleagues in the field and at WHO. And let's stay with another crisis that is taking the headlines at the moment. We move to Afghanistan. We've already heard from UNHCR on Tuesday about the situation of the returnees from Pakistan to Afghanistan. And I have the pleasure to, just take this off. To welcome on the podium our colleague Stephanie Luz, who is the country program manager for UN Habitat. Afghanistan, yes, it's under strong pressure, so we'll hear from you about the reintegration efforts for the refugees. Please, Stephanie.
Okay, good, thank you. Thanks. So thank you, Alexandra, and thanks for everyone for coming and for the interest. My name is Stephanie Luz. I'm heading the Afghanistan office for UN Habitat, and I do understand that you don't often have people from UN Habitat speaking to you, so I was advised to at least tell you what the agency is doing. We are the UN entity which is responsible for cities and sustainable human settlements, and so our aim is to improve the lives of people living practically in any settlement of any size, and this includes really in crisis settings like in Afghanistan. My key messages today is that Afghanistan is, as you've heard from colleagues from UNHCR, from IOM, UN Women, from a lot of different actors actually, that Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented refugee crisis. Millions of people have been forcibly returned or voluntarily repatriated from neighboring countries such as Iran or Pakistan. And while humanitarian support is provided at border points, I just want to highlight that the real challenge is still ahead of us. So we're speaking about the reintegration of people who've lost their homes, who've lost their assets, and also their hope. And many in Afghanistan don't have a place to go because they've never actually lived in Afghanistan. 60% of those who are returning now are below 18, so they don't have any social ties, they don't have any networks, and there is a real risk for them, you know, like sort of taking negative coping mechanisms. And for many of them, it's actually not a reintegration, but it's a really new start in a country which, as you all know, is very complex. So we need urgently a coordinated reintegration process, not only at the border points, but in areas where people will live, where they will settle. And from UN Habitat perspective, and I think most of the humanitarian actors would also agree, it actually starts with shelter, it starts with having a home. Just 4 points about the country context. You've heard that many times. Afghanistan is struggling due to fragile political, economic, and also social state of the country. And even before the crisis, 50% of the population have been classified as need. The humanitarian situation is dire, but also the human rights situation is deteriorating, specifically for women and girls. And then, on top of that, Afghanistan is among the top 10 countries that is impacted by climate change. So droughts, floods, heat waves, you have it all impacting the rural population, but also those who are living in the informal settlements in urban areas, and that is up to 80% of the population living in urban areas. That means you have 80% of the population in a city like Kabul, which is about 5 or 6 million, no one actually knows. And now on top of that, you know, not for Kabul, but all over the country, you add another 3 million people who are in dire need of support, and not only when they enter the country, but actually when they start settling in order to move forward. So just to give you some figures, you've heard them before, and UNHCR has kindly just provided me with the figures as of today. So we have 2.2 million people who've come since September of 2023. But just actually, you know, like speaking about, no, wait, you have 3 million that came from September 2023, but you've got 2.2 million who've just come since beginning of 2025. So 2.2 million people added to a population where 50% is already like classified it as need. And as I said, many arrive without anything, just what they can carry. I've just recently accompanied our special representative of the Secretary General for Afghanistan and the head of UNAMA, Rosa, onto Bayeva, to the border crossing to Iran. And I have to be very honest, I think it was just heartbreaking. It was one of those days where we had like 40,000 people crossing the border, arriving at a border point. And you see families, you see men, you see women, and you see, you know, like kids arriving to a country. It's like 35 degrees, it's dusty, it's windy, and they arrive with everything they can carry. And I mean, I have a daughter, so I look at, you know, like those teenage girls, and I know they're being pushed back into a country where there's no education for girls beyond 12, where they don't actually know where to go, and where there's actually specifically for women and girls no social and no economic development opportunities. And we also have woman-headed households who return to the country. So you can just imagine actually what it means to them. They cannot actually leave their houses without being accompanied by mahram, a male guardian, even if they want to go and see a doctor. And so, well, sorry. Let me just say what is needed. So reintegration efforts are not optional. Rebuilding life takes more than just emergency supplies, and it takes more than just humanitarian approaches. It needs integrated approaches for those areas where people live. It needs adequate housing and tenure rights. People need access to basic services, to water, to sanitation, and overall they do need livelihood opportunities for having a long-term perspective and for also allowing them to, you know, lead their lives in dignity and to support their families. Reintegration of large number of displaced people is a humanitarian crisis for the individuals, but it needs systematic, systemic, and locally grounded approaches, and specifically for those that move to the urban areas, to the fringes of those areas, to the informal settlements, which have not been planned, which are informal, which are completely underserved. You do need an integrated approach which is based on an urban planning and urban extension. Reintegration is also critical for a peaceful future in Afghanistan, because if you come back to a country where resources are already scarce, where there's a lot of competition among people already for jobs, for land, for housing, for any sort of services, it's very clear that if you don't foster dialogue between the local population and those who are arriving, this feeling of competition will grow, and it will really reduce the social cohesion in the country, which is like creating another root cause for war and war and conflicts, and the country has really seen enough of that. So for UN Habitat, one of the messages actually is that also for reintegration efforts, you have to make sure that people understand that returnees, displaced people, are not just a burden. They come with skills, they're part of the solution for social economic stability, and you know, they just have to be part of this society overall. UN Habitat is part of a coordinated and joint approach that is led by the RC and together with the other UN agencies and also our partners under the leadership of the resident coordinator and, of course, in cooperation with the political mission. We advocate for an integrated response based on spatial / urban planning that includes population growth from the very beginning. We need more shelter / housing solutions for people where they settle. So it's not short-term solutions, but it's longer-term solutions, longer-term thinking. People need improved access to services. And all of that can only be done in a participatory approach that includes the communities where people settle. And UN Habitat has a long, long, long history on this in Afghanistan. So let me just advocate, as my four speakers also did, don't forget Afghanistan, even though it's not active fighting. Don't forget the people of Afghanistan, specifically the women and girls. And please make sure that there's at least adequate funding for ensuring that people can live in dignity and also on their pathways to actually get out of humanitarian support and live in a dignified way and self-reliant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Thank you. It's so important to continue highlighting these dire situations, as you said, even if they are not, you know, under the physical fire, but the needs are immense and the suffering is too. I see that there is a solution for the hand raise button. It's in the heart, react under at the bottom of the screen. So I see two hands up. Imogen, I understand your question is not on Afghanistan. So let me go to Elaine Fletcher. Human health policy.
Hi, sorry, I apologize. I also had trouble finding the button, but it's also on Sudan, not Afghanistan.
Oh.
Apologies.
That's an issue because I think our colleagues, Eugene is still here.
I apologize. I wasn't able to find the button fast enough when you were asking.
Okay, let me see if there are questions on Afghanistan and then I'll come back to you and to Imogen. Is there any, now that we know where the raise hand function is, yes, Catherine Bianco.
Yes, good morning, Stephanie. It's nice to see you back in Geneva. Congratulations for all the work you're doing. I'm following you everywhere and you're doing an incredible work. Really congratulations for what you're doing every day. And I'd like to know more about the conditions of your work and the money needed, and also about the funds. We often speak about the funds cutting. How much are you affected? And have you found solutions in order to fill the gap? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Catherine. And yes, it is. It's nice to be back in Geneva, and I'm actually leaving to Kabul again tomorrow. So it's a real pleasure for me to be here today. Well, what to say? I mean, I cannot shoot out a number. You know, we're speaking about, 2.2 million people who need support for reintegration. The UN, in a coordinated approach, actually, under the leadership of the resident coordinator and also the durable solutions advisor of UNAMA, we launched an appeal in May where we didn't have those numbers. We had really smaller numbers, and I think the overall amount was already 120 million. So, you know, whatever number I now put forward, I know that in the current situation and, you know, with all the other crises, which we do acknowledge are also really pressing, it's very difficult to say, yes, for Afghanistan, we need, you know, like 250 million on the spot. We all know it's not, you know, it's not going to happen. What we do need is actually to make sure that the reintegration programs do receive, like, support, financial support, because a lot of the donor countries and which I also understand, you know, they support the humanitarian response at the borders, which, you know, like, is very imminent because you can easily measure it. You can say, we've handed out so many kids, we've handed out, you know, those sort of things. But what is actually needed is investments in longer-term solutions. So, I mean, happy on the UN Habitat side to, of course, give you a number, you know, what we would need. But would that cover it? Can one agency cover it? No, we can't. So it needs actually a coordinated cross-sectoral approach from not only the UN, but also, you know, the NGOs, everybody acting in the country. And as I said, I mean, I can put a number forward like 250 million, but that's, you know, that's never going to be accurate. So what can I say? We have been, of course, all impacted by the funding cuts. And I mean, UN Habitat is a technical agency. So, of course, our teams have already, like, been, I would say, cut dramatically when there was the break, when there was a takeover from the Taliban, because we're a development-oriented agency and, you know, we used to be the biggest agency in Afghanistan. Now we're a technical agency. So, of course, everybody, and now with the cuts from the US side, but also, of course, all the other major donors, of course, we're all facing the impact. And at the moment, of course, for our agency, we didn't have US funding, so the impact is not immediate, but we're a small agency and we're 100% project funded. So I don't know if you know what that means, but 100% project funded means that whatever you do, you first need to have the money. And I think our approaches are very long-term. They're oriented towards helping people actually to get out of being in need. I think that's actually what's needed in a country context like Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Let me see if there are other questions specifically on Afghanistan to UN Habitat. I don't see other hands up. So thank you very much, Stephanie. Thanks for having thought about coming to the briefing during your stay in Geneva. Have a nice trip back and good luck with your important work. And keep us informed now that you know that you can do it from Kabul.
I will. Thank you.
So, I see that Dr. Noor is still connected. Eugene has come back on the podium. So, Elaine, if you want to ask your question on Sudan, we will see to whom it was and if we can get an answer. Please, Elaine.
Thanks very much. Elaine Fletcher from Health Policy Watch. And I apologize, I missed part of your briefing, but I wanted to ask why I don't hear more condemnation from the UN as to the UAE's role in supporting RSF. I don't hear as much accountability to the parties. As you know, in Gaza, we hear when Israel does something, we hear very clear clarion calls to that Israel should cease. But I don't hear the same kind of moral clarity or on Sudan, and so we wind up with an impression or accounts of what's going wrong on the ground, but we don't have any sort of narrative about how to fix it that's coming from UN parties. Thank you.
Well, I can't really agree with you that there has not been a strong call from the UN on the solution of the conflict. As you know, we have been working all along this conflict to try and bring the warring parties to the table of negotiations. We have had the Secretary General has been very vocal on this issue. I don't know if there is anybody who wants to add something. I could send you a few information about what has been said and what has been done, but the reality, the bottom line, is that we have here two warring parties, and there is what is lacking is the will to stop. This is a totally man-made conflict. There is absolutely no reason for which it should not stop tomorrow morning. So obviously this is what we have been invoking, and I think our colleague on the ground, I don't know if we still have any of them. We have.
If I just might ask, though, Alessandra, has there been any pressure applied to the UAE, as such? I haven't heard. We hear about the RSF, and we know the UAE is supporting them, but I haven't heard much condemnation or pressure applied to the UAE regarding their support for RSF, which, as we know, was the genocidal partner in Darfur years ago, too. So has there been anything said to the UAE, any approaches, any? I don't even understand myself fully why the UAE is so engaged there. And I think there more elaboration on that would be really helpful.
Well, I leave the analysis to you on this particular point, but I think we've said, it has been said several times, that we are really calling on all the parties who have an influence on the warring parties to use this influence in the sense of going towards the end of the conflict. If I can find something more specific on your question, I will, Elaine. But please refer to all the things that have been said. Even here, when we hosted several speakers that have been talking about the conflict. But I'll see if I can find you something more specifically on your question. But I think we've been advocating very clearly for all the parties who have an influence on the conflict to use it to bring the warring party to talk and bring an end to this awful conflict. I don't know if there's anybody who wants to add anything. I don't know if Sadiq or our colleague from UNHCR or WHO. Now that we know where the hand function is, if you want to add something, please just raise your hand. And I'm not seeing. Let me check with the platform. Eugene, I don't know if you want to say something more. No? Okay, so thank you very much for this question. I see that we are left with questions from Imogen and Jamie. I understand both are not on Afghanistan or Sudan, so thanks very much to the colleagues. Imogen, let me see if we got Jens, because I think your question was for OCHA. I have contacted Jens, but he has not connected yet. But if you want to ask your question, please go ahead, and I'll eventually bring it to him.
Yeah, thanks for taking my question. Can you confirm that UN officials met with GHF on Wednesday in New York to discuss ways of working together?
So you're referring to a dialogue on the humanitarian situation in Gaza, which happened, I understand, in New York, that's right? Is that what you're
To discuss ways of working together, apparently.
With the GHF, yeah. What I can say is that at the invitation of the U.S. mission, the UN entities and partners attended a dialogue on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. The chairman of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was in attendance. It was a private meeting, and of course, we welcome any initiative, anyone raising their voice to help the civilians in Gaza. This is what I can say. This was a private meeting, but I can confirm it happened, and we were in attendance. Thank you. Jamie.
Thank you, Alessandra. I might as well pick up on that from Imogen. Who was in attendance for OCHA, and what was the result, if any, from that meeting? And if you could you just also, you said that it was the U.S. mission. I take it you're talking about the U.S. mission in New York. Is that what you're referring to? So please just tell us who. I mean, was Mr. Fletcher there himself?
Okay, so unfortunately, what I have just said is all I have about this meeting. And yes, I can confirm you. I'm speaking about the U.S. mission in New York. But I don't have more details to share with you, unfortunately. Jamie.
Hi, yes. Okay, well, I want to go back to my original question. Can you give us some, obviously we've got this announcement from the Israeli cabinet overnight about Gaza. It'd be very useful to have a statement from the United Nations about what the impact that is and what, if any, concerns you may have about it.
Yes, indeed. Yes, of course, we have seen the announcements of the Israeli cabinet. I can say that if confirmed, this we'll see what happens, but any decision to expand Israel's military operations in Gaza are deeply alarming. And obviously, it is clear that this would risk catastrophic consequences for millions of Palestinians and could further endanger the lives of the remaining hostages in Gaza. It has to be really clear. We really stand firmly on any escalation of the conflict. This has been an extremely ruinous conflict. We have seen the huge amount of victims only in the last 2 years. And the level of humanitarian suffering is beyond imagination. So obviously, any possible escalations would bring more suffering, would bring the starvation situation that we are seeing to higher levels. It would make our support, the provision of humanitarian aid, even more difficult. So it is really important to underline that we do not need more escalations of the conflict in Gaza. And I will refer you to the statement, to the comment of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, who has just been sent to all of you, where he says, again, what I've just said, that these escalations does not have to happen. He says the war in Gaza must end now, and Israelis and Palestinians must be allowed to live side by side in peace. He says instead of intensifying this war, the Israeli government should put all its effort into saving the lives of Gazan civilians by allowing the full unfettered flow of humanitarian aid. The hostages must be released immediately and unconditionally by Palestinian armored groups, and Palestinians arbitrarily detained by Israel must also be immediately and unconditionally released. If we have more on this matter, of course, we will send it to you today. Any other question for me or for colleagues? I don't see any other hand up, so thank you very much. I just wanted to add that, as you know, we are continuing to have the negotiations on the plastic pollution treaty here at the Palais. I repeat what I've said last time, that is that the journalists are very welcome to use the facilities to stay in the Palais, to access the Palais in the evening, and stay in the evening, and if needed, over the weekend, or at least on Saturday for sure. Sunday, I think we will have a recess. We have in Geneva two communication officers, the head of news and media and the communication officer for the talks. They are here, so if you need anything from them, just let us know. We have Keisha and Mats. I think I've already introduced them to you, but otherwise we can give you their contacts so that if you have any specific question about the talks, please don't hesitate to let us know. We will put you in contact with them. Eliane, I don't know if this is for you, but I see that Sadiq has raised his hand. Sadiq, you wanted to add something maybe on one of the questions?
Yes. Sorry for not being able to reflect at that time, but I would like to reflect on the questions in relation to the United Arab Emirates. I think there are many other states that they provide weapons. You know, the weapons are coming from different countries. Ammunitions are coming from different countries. I would say there is a need for, a bit of work in terms of informing those states that what is the implication of those weapons that are used in mainly in the urban settings of Sudan, and leaving behind the dangerous and exploded ordnance that will last for ages. It's not going to be a short-term problem. It is going to be a long-term problem. And, even future generations will be affected by this this problem. So we reached out to the Office of the Personnel Envoy of Secretary General in Addis. We had a meaningful discussions there. And we actually provided some information and key points that to be considered for by the Personnel Envoy of Secretary General for Sudan for his engagement with the relevant states. I think in terms of there is a need for in terms of advocacy work, there is a need for reminding the states about the relevant international humanitarian laws and their responsibilities for when it comes to those contamination that is left behind for years to come. So this is just wanted to add. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Siddiq. I think this will be useful, I hope, for Elaine. Any other question or any other speaker would like to add something? I don't see any hands, so thank you very much for following the briefing. I wish you a good weekend, and we'll see you on Tuesday. Thank you.